Radiolab is supported by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, exercising, cleaning. What if you could also be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com, Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Wait, you're listening.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radiolab.
From
WNYC.
See?
Yep.
Okay, ready? Hey, yep. I'm Lulu Miller.
I'm Latif Nasser.
This is Radiolab, and this week we are bringing you four stories, four celebrations, if you will, about the overlooked, the ignored,
the unsung places in our world. From the cells inside our bodies, to the treetops above us, to the distance between all things, we are going to look at the overlooked. Overlooked, they will not be any longer.
As we look. And to start us off on this journey, we are going to start small. I mean, microscopically small, with a story that Jad hosted a few moons back. And we should say that this story does contain some language that is not suitable for littles, so be forewarned. And now, on to Jad.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad. This is Radiolab. This week, we want to share a story that really caught our attention. It's a story told by this guy.
My name is Brandon Obunu. I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at Brown University.
It's a story he told on stage for the podcast Story Collider, which is a live storytelling show. Huge thanks to them for letting us borrow this. It's a story that, you know, touches on all the things that we're all thinking about right now. Takes it into some new territory. Brandon started the story when he told it on stage with an incident that happened to him in college when he's living in D.C.
Rule number one. When you see the lights at your back or in your eyes, and they're unmistakable, stop moving. Raise your hands slowly from their side, 5 fingers extended, so that they know that there's nothing in your hands. Stop, wait for instructions. You see, you have to think about the police report. You don't want it to say that he lunged, or he reached for something that looked like a weapon, or the mysterious, he made a menacing gesture. No, officer, I'm not carrying any weapons. That's rule number two. Use officer early and often. Why? You have to let them know that you know the power dynamic. After all, they got the badge and the gun. You, you were just born with the wrong set of physical traits. Officer number one stood with the gun loaded, pointed towards me, ready to go, ready to be a hero. Officer number two approached. Are you carrying any drugs, sir? Sir, right? I guess I respect that. No, officer. After a thorough search, and I mean thorough, the interest turned to the contents of my backpack, a black JanSport that had some bad graffiti on the small pocket. I was a senior at Howard University, a chemistry and mathematics major at the time. And like most people at that stage, my backpack told a lot about me. There was some moldy potato chips in the bag, right? Some sketch pads and some notepads, a copy of Source magazine, and a couple mixtapes, and I mean real mixtapes, not the stuff that you guys talk about. And much, much more. Officer number two had to sift through the contents, and I heard all the ruffling. Eventually, officer two emerged with an object of interest and slammed it on the hood of the car, and under the flashlight, it went. Leninger, Nelson, and Cox, Principles of Biochemistry, second edition. Officer two was persistent, however, and raised the book and shook it out, trying to find the contraband. And officer two was successful. Down went several note cards that were placed in the chapter on Michaelis Menten kinetics. Officer number two was persistent still and ruffled through the contents of the bag and emerged with another item, a little bit smaller, slammed it on the hood of the car. A draft of my senior thesis, highly annotated, with the title, The Liberation of RNA. Now,
the story that you tell begins with the sort of oh-so-familiar pulled over by cops.
Right.
When was that, by the way?
Late fall of 2001.
Huh. Producer Soren Wheeler and I ended up calling up Brandon, asking him a few questions about the story.
I mean, just to add a little bit of context, this is around the time of the Amadou Diallo case.
Oh, wow.
in New York. It's like a couple years after that, probably. Interacting with law enforcement has been a part of my life since really, you know, right after, you know, early adolescence.
So the liberation of RNA, this thesis that they find in your bag, what kind of work were you doing at that point?
So I was a chemistry major in math. I studied math a lot. So I was math and chemistry, and I had joined Susan Gottesman's lab.
More on her in a second.
In college. She had made this discovery of these RNA molecules that kind of regulated genes. And my work was focused on one of those small RNA molecules, these autonomously functioning RNA molecules that were responsible for switching genes on and off. And that was a pretty new discovery. RNA, we thought RNA was just this informational intermediate between DNA and protein. But I think in the 90s, we learned that RNA actually does things in a cell. It can actually function like an enzyme. It's doing things in a cell. Like now, this is kind of common knowledge. But back then, that was a pretty new discovery. That this stuff is really active and is an important part of the way life functions across the biosphere.
So when you say liberate RNA, you mean let's give RNA its due.
That's right.
That it needs to be elevated.
Yes, yes.
We had historically put RNA in a box, but RNA was bigger than that.
And so you describe in your story that RNA was in a box. I wonder, did you see RNA as a kind of, what's the not dumb way to ask this, as a like analog to your own life?
Oh, totally. Well, totally.
Really?
I mean, I think I absolutely use my science as, you know, I do my science biographically. In all of my science, even now, I find a personal connection to the essence of the question, which is why I was writing a thesis called The Liberation of RNA. And as when I wrote about the liberation of RNA, there was nothing explicitly political in that. It was about RNA.
Right.
It was totally a biochemistry thesis. But nonetheless, I definitely saw that thread that, you know, Susan Gottesman kinda and colleagues had discovered this set of molecules that kind of had expanded our appreciation of what was possible. And I kind of felt that was a little bit of a metaphor for my whole life at that point.
And did you feel like, I mean, because you identified with RNA and, you know, the orthodoxy is DNA is everything, you are your genes. Did you then have a adversarial relationship to DNA? Or is that?
No, I didn't have an adversarial relationship with DNA. I still love DNA, and I think DNA is, you know, one of the most, I got no beef with DNA, but I think.
It's a great molecule.
It's a great molecule. A lot of my best friends are DNA, but I do, I from early, and at that point, I was politically aware and scientifically aware. I was aware of things like, for example, like scientific racism. That was definitely something I was aware of. And I was definitely aware of the ways that DNA was weaponized in scientific racism, even at that stage.
Yeah. All right. So maybe we should circle back to Susan Gottesman, whose lab you're working in at that point.
I conducted this research in the laboratory of Susan Gottesman at the National Institutes of Health. To this day, one of my truest scientific heroes. Both maybe the nicest and the smartest person I've ever had the pleasure of meeting, let alone working with. She might have stood 5'3", but she towered over the field. Her work used bacterial genetics to understand kind of basic questions in bacterial physiology. And recently, she had discovered several small RNAs in bacterial and in E. coli. And I focused a lot of my work in my lab on that. I owed a lot to Dr. Gottesman. She saw talent in me before I did. She believed in me and gave me an opportunity. And a lot of the greatness of Dr. Gottesman came out in my failures. I was coming from chemistry where, like, yeah, you might have an explosion, but there was no contamination, you know? Right? And so I had fairly heavy hands in the laboratory. And she would say things like, you being smart is not going to make a correct bacterial growth curve, Brandon. Or even better, yeah, I think you'll be a good theoretician one day. But I owed everything to Dr. Gottesman. I was young and naive at the time, but I understood that I was working for somebody very special, and I was honored to be connected to her. 15 or so years later...
So you jump forward 15 years. Can you just, before we get to that next scene, connect the dots? Who were you in the interim?
So after leaving Susan's lab, I actually did a Fulbright in Kenya where I studied malaria.
Oh.
And I come back, I enter medical school at Yale.
Wow.
Then I switched into a PhD program where I did my PhD in virus evolution at Yale. And I haven't looked back. So I'm at this point, I'm a professor.
I'm sitting on a sectional couch in front of a 60-inch HD TV, 4K. That I own. It's January 2019. I got olive tamponade hummus, cauliflower chips, and a local root beer. And I'm tuned in to watch a movie. PBS American Masters Decoding Watson. This documentary was about James Watson. Now, James Watson's been an asshole for decades. Right? Hold on.
We should probably say that James Watson is part of the duo that discovered the double helix structure of DNA. He has made racist comments at several points during his career and gotten in trouble for it.
And presumably, I was tuning in because, this is a good series, the Decoding... The Masters, American Masters, have been good. And you can learn. There's always something interesting to learn about people. But really, I confess that I was tuning in kind of like most people tune in when they're watching boxing. You can say, well, I want to see a match of stars, but you want to see a knockout, right? You want to see something kind of dramatic happen. And James Watson delivered. Doubling down on his 2007 comments, where he said, though I hoped people are equal, people who have to deal with black employees don't believe this to be true. He had further things to say about black people and white people, differences he attributed to genetics. My visible demeanor oscillated between kind of horrified shuddering and kind of uncomfortable laughter, but inside, I was hurting.
So I had been keeping up with James Watson through the years just because I had read all the stuff. I had read his biography. I knew a lot about him. I think what was jarring about that experience for me was everything else I had read that he said. So I had actually never seen him say any of these troubling things before. It really made my skin crawl. And it became personal in an odd way when I heard him say it.
Interestingly enough, however, those comments were not the most notable part of that documentary film. What I noticed was several notable female women scientists, right, were in the film and had passed through, right, his lab at various points and were talking, famous people. And I was like, wow, this is very interesting given, right, Watson's, right, similarly problematic past when it comes to, right, gender. So I said, that doesn't quite fit my narrative. And that's pretty interesting. And to his credit, none of the women scientists said that working for him, that the environment was particularly toxic. They kind of had interesting things to say about his personality, but I found that to be very, very interesting. So then the question emerged in my head. I wonder how many other famous women scientists worked for James Watson. I took my inquiry to Google. James Watson, academic family tree. Now, you know, there are, right, there are websites dedicated to being a genealogy academically, the same way, right, you do with your family, and there's a site, academicfamilytree.org, I believe. I click on it. At the top of the page, one of those classical James Watson photos with the insufferable smile and the bad hairline, right? My eyes went down the page, and it said, children. And the first name in the children's section, Susan Gottesman, research assistant. Now, my response was in my mother tongue, a highly technical language. Get the out of here. Wait, can't be true, all right? But it was true. There was no section that read grandchildren, because if there was, and there was no section because his grandchildren likely number in the thousands at this point, but if there was, one of them would have been an evolutionary systems biologist at Brown University who likes long walks in the park and open world video games, and whose mother experienced the Jim Crow South, and whose great-grandmother was born a slave.
When you saw that you were only one person away from him, how did that compute?
Well, a couple things. He said these racist things. I bet he didn't think, you know, kids from public housing were going to end up being his, you know, being in his pedigree.
Yes.
And
yes.
Who have the views that I have and who promote the things that I promote in science and who say the things that I say and hold my views. Here I am eating my olive tamponade hummus on my comfortable couch, watching my nice television, and I'm James Watson's grandson and he can't do nothing about it. And I got my whole and I got a whole career in front of me where I'm gonna embarrass those kind of ideas. And so it caused a lot of reflection.
But what are academic connections anyway, really? Like, I don't know them. I hope I never know them. The connection is kind of nebulous and tenuous in these types of ways that kind of don't matter, right? But the connection between me and James Watson is about more than the profession. And the connection between all of us and James Watson is about more than science. James Watson was officers number one and number two. James Watson is why you feel unwelcome in your job. James Watson makes you feel like an imposter. And more broadly, James Watson tells people they're illegal. James Watson separates families. James Watson puts children in cages. James Watson, my academic grandfather. The contents of my backpack were spread all over the police car at this point, the hood of the police car at this point. Officer number one and number two looked at each other with a look like, what the hell do we do now? Eventually, officer number one said, You can get your things and go. Now, this was supposed to be humiliating. Here I am minding my business, and I have to stop and put all my things back into the bag. But sometimes resistance is best dealt quietly. And so I figured out a way to make this work for me. I took my sweet ass time putting my materials back into that bag, one by one. And with it, I was saying two things. A, them hands y'all got on them guns could help me put these things back in this bag. And B, the things I'm putting in this bag, the ideas they contain, some mine, some from others, are valuable. I have people in the world who love me. I have dreams of one day being a great professor. And I had to be at work in the morning in the Gottesman lab. As I was completing the process of putting the things in my bag, I looked at the last item, that thesis, the liberation of RNA. And I put it in the bag and zipped it. I didn't miss the opportunity for one last slam dunk. I turned my head to the officers, said, "Have a good night." I slung the JanSport around my shoulders. I eased into a deep New York strut. On a road to a career in science, a very rugged fitness landscape, full of peaks and valleys, successes and failures, friends and enemies, Susan Gottesmans and James Watsons. Thank you.
Have you ever talked to Susan Gottesman about this and said, "Hey, I saw it on this website, and what was that like?" Had you ever broached it with her?
So, unfortunately, I haven't, but I think you might be interested to hear why. In some ways, that would be making an assumption that he's, like, significant to her. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, she's built this life and career that, I mean, I don't know him personally, but I've read a lot of his work. I mean, she's smarter than he is, right? I mean, no, I think that, I'm confident saying that. You know, in terms of obviously the size of his discoveries are gigantic and enormous, but, you know what I'm saying? But the work, the cleverness and the way she's understands nature and what she's done in all these multiple ways, I think is more impressive. In some ways, I'm kind of like,
as if, it's like, maybe
condescending
the fact
some
that,
ways.
Yeah, like if that, mm-hmm. almost like the fact that she worked for or with him.
I mean, matters in some way. Right.
That was like the most, like, an impressive thing
important
about
thing
her.
Of her career.
Right.
It's just not at all. Yeah. And that's why she didn't, part of me was like, "Oh, I wonder why she didn't mention it." She didn't mention it because it didn't matter.
I'm tempted to make a connection between that decision not to talk to her about him and you slowly putting the papers back in your mm-hmm. bag. Do you see a connection there?
I mean, I think, you know, I mean, I, you know, it's not, that's not a connection that I actively made at the time, but I think it's a theme with how resistance works. And when you are dealing with something uncomfortable with life, and this transcends the Black experience, when you're dealing with something uncomfortable with life that you can't do anything about, and you can't do anything about who your family is, or academic or other. And in this situation, I can't do anything about the fact that I'd been stopped and I'm dealing with this racial profiling incident. You look for little ways. And I think you're right. I think in not having a coffee conversation about him, in a weird way, like, I honored her more. Mm. Sometimes the most revolutionary thing or the most subversive thing you can do is just focus on the right things in life.
Yeah.
That's sometimes really, really it. And I think this goes back to something that Toni Morrison, one of her many myriad of incredible quotes, talked about: the function of racism is to distract. Yeah. Right. That's really what it does. I mean, it's just kind of like it takes your eye off of it, makes you do things that you shouldn't be, you know, doing. You want to prove people wrong. You want to prove you have a language. You want to prove that you're smart, and you do. And right. It's so chillingly, you know, true that sometimes the most powerful thing you can just do is be like, you know, be aware of what the situation is, but not give it that power over you and the things that matter most.
Huge, huge thanks to Brandon Obunu for sharing his story with us and with Story Collider. Story Collider is a nonprofit group that puts on live storytelling events and also puts out a podcast. Thank you to Story Collider's Aaron Barker and Liz Neely for letting us play Brandon's story. You can find out more about Story Collider at storycollider.org, and you can subscribe to their podcast through Apple or wherever you get your podcast from.
After the break, we go even deeper to another place inside you.
Hey, Lulu here. You asked, and we listened. You wanted a Zuzve shirt, and we made one. It is a gorgeous celebration of the liminal being that is Venus's moon/not moon. And you yourself can sport this homage to the unknowable multitudes of those all around you and within you by simply joining The Lab. The Lab is our membership program. That is the place where we fight the fight against the fickle whims of the economy to make our show protected from all that based on listener support. If you sign up, we thank you with the brand new Zuzve t-shirt and also ad-free episodes, bonus interviews, and other swaggy stuff like stickers and patches. You can go check out the perks and see if it's right for you by going to radiolab.org/join. And thank you either way for being here, for listening to our show. We make it for you, Zve. Anyway, radiolab.org/join. Check it out. And thanks.
Okay. Hey, I'm Latif Nasser.
I'm Lulu Miller. This is Radiolab. And for our second stop on our journey through unsung places.
Another place inside of us, from zooming out from our cells, going kind of floating up to our brain or thereabouts with a story from the very brainy Molly Webster.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no. Is that good?
Yeah. All right. So I ended up talking to this guy.
Mark Krasner, professor of biochemistry at Stanford University.
Okay, perfect. So Mark is a lung researcher.
My favorite topic. It's my favorite topic, obviously.
And we're going to pick up with him in like the early aughts.
Kind of a natural extension.
So he actually has this question of just like, well, what is actually controlling the rhythm of the lungs?
Exactly.
Like, what makes you breathe?
Exactly. Yeah.
So he starts doing some research, and he finds this paper that says if you go down to the base of your brain...
In what's called the brainstem.
It's kind of the space that goes up between that, like groove
that,
that you have at the back of your skull.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's right buried deep below that.
I can feel it right now.
And it is right there that Mark learned that there is this little clump of neurons
that are actually initiating each breath.
With every single pulse, they send a signal down the spinal cord,
your diaphragm, and the tiny muscles between your ribs,
telling them to expand. And then they send another signal telling them to contract. And this is just what these neurons do.
They are the pacemaker neurons.
Huh.
So there are 86 billion neurons in your brain, and it is just this clump of maybe 8,000 that do this very vital thing.
That seems very small.
It does seem very small, does it not?
Yes.
And so,
so Mark came across this paper, actually by this guy named Jack.
I consider Jack the father of the field.
Just a really quick Jack Feldman shout out.
Wonderful.
But when Mark came across Jack's research, we found out he just had this really simple question,
which was, "Hey, are all these neurons, are they all the same as one another, or are they different from one another?" And so we started interrogating these neurons.
And so he and some colleagues, what they did was they started looking at this group of neurons
in a mouse brain
under a microscope.
And
what it seemed to be a uniform mass of beating.
It turned out these neurons weren't all alike. There are over 50 different types.
Really?
Of the pacemaker neuron.
Huh.
Why are they different and what do they do that's special?
So to start, in mice, Mark decides to focus on this specific group.
These 200 neurons from the breathing pacemaker.
And basically, with some molecules and a syringe,
we can very precisely remove just those neurons.
And so Mark's team goes in. They shut down the 200 neurons. Mouse is happy. Mouse is alive. And basically what happens is mouse stops sighing.
What?
Which was like, whoa.
So I didn't know this, but mice sigh.
Aww. Huh. That's so cute.
And so that's just like saying like, oh, these 200 neurons control sigh.
And they are the only neurons, apparently, in the brain that have this specific function.
Weird.
Yes. And that's not all. In another experiment, they knocked out, again, like 150 neurons, and the rate of exhalation changes. So like, you know how you can go like, and then you go, and you can say, I want to exhale for 4 seconds,
mm-hmm.
or your body just does it naturally at some rhythm. They found that when they took out this one group of neurons, the rate of exhalation got much longer.
Huh.
And so they're like, oh, interesting. So they're starting to put together this little like visual map of like what all these different neurons do.
Mm-hmm.
They all must have a function, right?
Yeah. So this
And so they, you know, go to another group of neurons.
You know, roughly 150 neurons.
Knock them out. But this time.
Very, very disappointing.
Nothing happens. So like, that's weird. Like, did really nothing change, you know? And they realize a few days later that something did change.
That, hey, these mice look chillaxed. They are very calm.
They're just kind of licking their fur and hanging out in place.
Chill. Mellow.
It's like, what are these neurons?
Give me those.
And they start looking at what the neurons are connected to. You know how neurons can have those long, like, tentacle projections?
Mm-hmm.
And those let them communicate with other neurons?
Uh-huh.
And he realizes that where they actually go is directly to the fight or flight center of the brain.
Oh,
and so
wow.
The story that they've put together is that this group of neurons, what it's probably doing is sending updates about the status of the breath pacemaker to the fight or flight region, saying like, we're working, everything's okay over here. And they're like sending these little signals, giving it updates. And if something's wrong, they can send a thing straight to fight or flight and be like, mayday, mayday, breath is a mess.
Mm. Would it be the other way of like, you see something really scary, fight or flight then sends a signal to the breath pacemaker being like, pick up the pace?
So Mark walked me through this very cool thing.
So there are two great pacemakers in our body. One that many people know about is the pacemaker of the heart, which, you know, beats every second. And it's located right in the organ that it controls. It's right there in the heart.
So there's actually like pacemaker cells in your heart that do the rhythm of the beating.
Oh, really?
They're like directly on the organ that they make beat.
That's crazy.
But with breath, the other great pacemaker, it's located far from the organ that it controls. It's located in the brain.
And once you put breath into the brain, you allow evolution to put more on the breath than just a mechanical function. Like it starts getting integrated into like the emotional centers of the brain and the anxiety centers of the brain.
And those parts of the brain can impact and regulate breath, a sigh. And then there's, you know, a laugh, you know, or a cry, or even speech. You know, all of those are actually breathing.
So, yes, Matt, to answer your question, mm-hmm. you see something scary, a signal gets sent from the fight or flight to the breath pacemaker saying, pick up the pace, you know.
Uh-huh.
But what Mark's research shows is that it's going both ways. Mm. There's crosstalk. There's deep integration happening.
And the other key key aspect of the breathing pacemaker compared to the cardiac pacemaker is you can consciously control the breathing pacemaker.
That's the interesting.
You can hold your breath at least for a certain period of time, and you can change the output of the breathing paper. So you can override and alter the breathing pacemaker.
Is that why, like, if I take like a deep breath, I can actually calm myself down?
Yeah, that is the way that you're getting control of this communication between the breathing pacemaker and the fight or flight neurons.
Huh. And so in talking to Mark, I feel like in a way he almost gave me like a scalpel to get inside my own brain and control it. Like if I actually change my breathing, it will change this breath pacemaker region and it will send an I'm chill signal to the fight or flight directly and it will calm down.
Wow.
And so like last night, like when I kept waking up, like when I was sleeping, I was like, okay, I'm just going to breathe slowly. And then I'm just like, hi neurons. Like I'm breathing slowly now. So you can send the signal to the fight or flight that like, I'm okay. And like, I conduct this whole system. Like I can work the system.
After the break, we're traveling up into the sky to a very special, overlooked place.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, oh, 3 feet.
Because they were wondering when they were going to go to the moon. They wondered how much dust would be on the surface of the moon. And they were worried. I once wrote letters back and forth to Neil Armstrong. So one of the things that he told me, he said, was like, they really weren't at all sure how much dust there was on the moon and whether it was, you know, variable. So you'd be standing
I'm Lulu.
Here. I'm Latif. This is Radiolab.
And it would take your weight. And then you'd walk 3 steps forward and you'd go, and you'd be up to your knees in it.
And this, of course, is none other than Crowley, the Crowl. Robert Crowitch.
So I said to him, I don't know why you didn't walk around more. I mean, you went to another celestial body. The first
producer Annie McEwen called him up a few weeks back to talk not about the moon. Actually, they talked instead about a new kind of world that was discovered right here in the forests of planet Earth.
Okay, we're ready. We're at long last ready to begin.
Okay. Okay, so one of the first things I ever did when I got to Radiolab was work on a show of yours called Tree to Shining Tree.
I don't remember how long ago we did that. That was like 3 years ago or something?
It was 2016. Isn't that wild? Wow. I know. And for those of you who haven't heard the episode, you should go listen. It's amazing. But just a tiny recap here. It was all about the network that exists under the forest floor.
There's this whole other world right beneath my feet.
This network is this deeply complex interwoven mat of tree roots and these mushroom threads, these fungi, connecting all of these trees together and helping them share resources.
About the forest that exists underneath the forest.
Here from that episode is ecologist Suzanne Samard.
What we found was that the trees that were the biggest and the oldest were the most highly connected. And so we've identified these as kind of like hubs in the network. It's just this incredible communications network that, you know, people had no idea about in the past because didn't know how to look.
Anyway, we learn about all of this magical stuff that is happening right beneath our feet in the forest.
Yeah.
But for this episode, I wanted to call you because I recently learned about this new layer to the story.
Okay.
So in Tree to Shining Tree, we look down under the ground.
Right.
How about instead of looking down, we peer into a type of down that is in the up?
Oh, okay.
And to take us there,
alrighty,
forest royalty. I've read that you are known as the queen of the canopy. Is that true? Is that did that come from?
I have no idea where that came from. I've also been called the mother of the forest canopy.
Oh my goodness.
And now that I'm 67 years old, I think it's going to be sort of the dowager queen or
I think
the
you should
grandmother
be the empress.
Of forest canopies.
What about the empress?
This is ecologist Nalini Nadkarni, who, like a lot of kids, spent a large part of her childhood up in trees.
You know, you grab a branch, you put your leg over it, and suddenly you're up in the treetops. And for me, it was like kind of my place. I had this sort of chaotic, large family. You know, I'd come home from school with chores and homework, but the treetops of these 8 maple trees that lined my parents' driveway were kind of my refuge.
She'd spend whole afternoons up there just sitting and wondering.
I look at the leaves and I go like, why is this branch have much yellower leaves than that branch, which has oranger leaves?
Yes, such a good question.
And it's like, well, what is going on? Why? What is this branch independence? Or, you know, I'd watch squirrels jumping from one tree to another and just think, God, you know, where do they go? And what if I attached a spool of thread to the back of one of them and I could trace where they go? So, but it was a place for my imagination to sort of run wild.
Nalini grew up and followed that imagination to study ecology in grad school.
This was back in like the early 1980s, and I was just starting out, and I came to my graduate committee and I said, I know what I want to do with the rest of my career. I want to study the forest canopy. And they said, well, that's kind of like Tarzan and Jane stuff, you know, with so many questions to ask and answer on the forest floor. Why do you have to go into the canopy?
At that time, canopies were just basically not studied. They were hard to get up into, and there didn't seem to be a lot of point. The scientific thinking was, there's just not a lot going on up there.
But there was something about the canopy that I kind of just had this intuition that it's not enough to just stand on the ground and look up.
And so, with some modified mountain climbing equipment, she began to climb these giant old-growth trees in the Olympic rainforests of western Washington.
Which is what's called a temperate rainforest.
Are these the places where in the morning the fog from the Pacific Ocean comes rolling in?
Yeah.
And the tree just gets an every morning bath of just
pure
moisture.
And the tree just goes...
Yeah.
So Nalini climbs up into the canopy of this giant big leaf maple tree.
And I throw my leg over a branch and I'm sitting up there and I'm anchored with my rope and I'm looking around. I just see this enormous three-dimensional panoply of moving leaves and moving twigs.
The branch she's sitting on, as well as all the branches surrounding her, are covered in this super thick layer of
this amazing growth of mosses and lichens and ferns.
Kind of like the tree is wearing this very unruly green shag carpet.
You get the sense of being in a place that looks very simple from the forest floor, but is actually this kaleidoscope of life.
Her job up there was to take samples of the moss that was growing on these branches.
I had to cut off chunks of it.
So using some clippers, she begins to cut down into that moss on the branch she's sitting on.
And as I peeled back those mats of mosses,
beneath, instead of just bare branch,
I saw that there was all this soil up there.
This branch has a foot of soil piled up on it.
Oh, wow.
Soil that formed over many, many years of mosses and leaves dying and decomposing right there on the branch.
It's so weird because you're sitting up there in the canopy, like 100 feet above the ground, and then you're digging your fingers into the soil that could be the soil that's, you know, in your backyard garden, for goodness sake.
You can imagine getting your gardening gloves out and planting rows of tulips 100 feet in the air.
There were like invertebrates in it. There were earthworms in it.
Tree worms?
Yes.
That is so weird.
I know.
Even the stars of the old episode, the fungi, were there.
Really? So the mushrooms have climbed up the tree as well to sort of do their thing.
They're sharing resources. They're helping the tiny plants up there communicate with one another.
The same as on the forest floor.
It's almost like she stumbled into a perfect miniature of the forest floor she had just climbed up away from. And straddling a branch way up high in the air, she's like, huh.
Well, that's cool.
This was in the 80s, and since then there have been so many more, well, that's cools, because more and more scientists have been accessing this new world using cranes and ropes or building platforms, or my favorite way up into a tree is this French guy, Francis Allais, who pioneered the use of the dirigible to access the canopy.
Oh, wow.
There's incredible pictures
of these. So it's a balloon trip that he takes?
It's a balloon that floats over the tops of this green ocean,
just kissing the tops of the trees, and the scientists can just gently lean and trim this and that. And anyway, so one way or another, all over the world, scientists began getting themselves up into trees and documenting what they saw there. And some of the coolest discoveries were found on the West Coast in the old-growth redwood forests. And oh my gosh, these giants were found to be holding these pockets of soil up to 3 feet deep. And growing in the soil were flowers, berry bushes, mosses, lichens. They found salamanders living hundreds of feet in the air who spend their entire lives never touching the ground.
I'm waiting for you to say a small deer or something like that, or something very
I don't have a small deer for you, but I do have something that I find totally bizarre, which is that up in redwoods, scientists have found these tiny aquatic creatures.
An aquatic creature?
It's aquatic, yeah. It's like the shrimp-like...
They found a fish?
Pretty much, it's like the shrimp-like thing, a species of something called a copepod.
Oh.
Copepods, which is actually this whole subclass of creatures. They're the most abundant animal in the ocean and a huge part of the diet of baleen whales. This thing is like swimming around in these mossy mats and no one knows how it got there. Anyway, these tree canopies that up until the mid-80s, everyone thought were just pretty much empty, not only are they not empty, they actually hold about 50% of all terrestrial life on the planet.
Did you say 50%?
50%? 50, 50. Yeah.
Wow, that's a weird number. That, you're saying 50% of it is up in the air somewhere?
Yeah, up in the air, up in trees.
Whoa.
Which, you know, sounds kind of unbelievable, but when you think of places like the Amazon, all those bugs, birds, plants, animals, it adds up. And most of this life has made a home in these canopy soils.
What? Soil on the tree branches?
When ecologist Karina Mifune learned about these canopy soils,
I fell in love. I was like, okay, there's like a forest in a forest on a forest. I need to research this.
And she told me that thinking about these canopy soils like these tiny, perfect replicas of the forest floor below wasn't quite right. Because these canopy soils, they have something that the forest wants.
Huh. Well, what would that be?
Well, back when she was a grad student in the Washington Olympic Peninsula, Karina collected soil samples from the forest floor throughout the year. And she noticed that
in the spring growing season, there aren't as many nutrients available.
Specifically, there was a lack of phosphorus and nitrogen, two important things that every plant in the springtime wants to help them, you know, put forth new leaves, to help them grow.
And those are rare. Plants love that.
Right.
Yeah.
And in contrast to the last episode where we talked about trees cooperating with each other.
All these trees that were of totally different species were sharing their food underground. Like if you put...
Karina told me that in that same sharing forest, when resources are scarce...
There's a ton of competition on the forest floor. Trees have roots grafted together. There's mycorrhizal networks, you know, that are spanning across. There's this big battle to, you know, uptake nutrients. But
Karina had also taken samples of the canopy soils, and she saw that during these times of scarcity below,
these canopy soils had so much more nitrogen and phosphorus available for plant uptake compared to their forest floor counterparts.
Meaning that this soil for a plant was creme de la creme.
It's just amazing.
Downstairs, there's shortage. Upstairs, there's abundance. When it's crumbs down below, up in the sky, held aloft above the plebeian masses, is like a Thanksgiving dinner. And when Karina learned this, she thought, I don't know.
What do these canopy soils mean? Because they're not just hanging out there. They're not just there for no reason, right?
She's right. They're not. These sky gardens, they get even better.
Better at what?
Hmm?
Better at what?
Well, let's just say they're not alone up there.
What's about to happen?
So to understand this wizardry, we need to go back to Nalini.
Fine with me.
And this amazing discovery that she made.
Okay, so I remember sitting on this tree.
She's back up in a tree in the Washington rainforest, digging around in this canopy soil.
And I began seeing these root systems that were running up and down the branches of these trees.
They didn't look like they belonged to moss or ferns or any other plant you could see up there.
And there were fine roots all the way up to, some of them were the diameter of my wrist. I mean, these were gigantic roots.
What?
And I thought, well, that's weird. What are these roots doing here?
Huh.
So I began just tracing the roots that I was finding.
Like you took hold of one root in your hand and sort of like went backwards like a string?
Right. Exactly, like it's like following a string. Huh. Exactly.
She gently excavates this root, scooting along the branch as she uncovers it.
I was tied in so I could sort of swing around and move from one branch to another. I had my water bottle with me, so then whenever it began difficult to sort of unstick the root, I could just throw a little water on it, keep going, keep following it. It was like, I don't know, it was like being a detective.
Well, what did you think it was going to lead to?
I had no idea. I thought, well, maybe there's some sort of vascular plant that I'm not aware of that's here, but I don't think so. So then
she follows the route all the way back to its beginning.
And oh my gosh! Its origin was a dead end in the tree itself.
What?
The big tree, the one Nalini is sitting in, is growing roots from its branch
and snaking underneath these mats of soil, of canopy soil.
Let me think about this. Somehow it realizes that it could find soil high up somewhere, like, and so it just takes its roots and its roots travel up and go whoop to the left and say, let's root not only where we normally root down there, but let's root up here.
Yes.
Whoa. So things that you thought were below can move above, way above, high above you.
Yes. It was a real revelation.
And Karina thinks that it's during a drought or during spring growing season when resources in the forest floor are scarce that these big trees...
That's when they can tap into their canopy soils. It's like they're like,
hey, there's a bunch of really great stuff here to suck on, so why don't you put out a root out here? And that's exactly what these trees do.
I kind of always compare it to like a secret cabinet that has all the good snacks in it. It's like if you were teaching a preschool, it's like while all of the school children are fighting over the snacks and fighting over these resources, you just go into your, you know, canopy soil closet and you got your good snacks up there.
Because we're looking for those special minerals like the phosphorus and stuff, and that's where we can find it.
Right. And it's finding it in its hat.
Yeah, finding it in its hat. That's a nice way of putting it, yes.
Yeah.
That's a lovely way of putting it, yes. The expression, I'm going to eat my hat, has now got a whole new meaning.
Oh, yes, Robert. I love that.
Yeah.
One thing that both Karina and Nalini told me is that this is a new field.
There is just so many things to be found high above the forest floor.
Like, for instance, Karina told me sometimes there are actual trees growing up there.
And I've seen, like, a 5-foot spruce growing out of a nook of canopy soil.
Wow.
And you'll see a lot of, like, baby maples growing up in the old maple. So it's like, you know, like a little nursery.
Wait a second. You mean there's a tree growing on the tree?
That's right.
On the branch?
In the soil on the branch.
Oh.
And who knows? Maybe as more people study the canopy, we'll find little trees on those trees. And maybe there will be little trees on those trees on those trees.
Yeah. It's fractal, like littler plants off the ground, and then little on them is the moss, which is little plants on top of little plants. So there's like there's little layers and layers and layers of life, and the more you go up, the more the layers you will find. That's sort of cool.
Thank you, Annie McEwen, for reporting and producing that gorgeous episode and leaving us with that image of not turtles all the way down, but trees all the way up.
And now for our final stop on this journey, probably the most expansive place of all. In fact, it's a place that's so expansive it blurs the line between space and time.
This is from reporting we did many, many years ago for our show Colors. Our producer, Lynn Levy, as well as Jad, sat down with a brilliant writer, Rebecca Solnit, to talk about the color blue.
Hello, Rebecca. Can you hear me?
Hi.
Hi, this is Lynn. How are you doing?
I can. I'm doing well.
I read your book, as I mentioned, A Field Guide to Getting Lost, and kind of fell in love with it, and gave it to Jad also. And we were both really sort of excited by this exploration that you do of the color blue and this like sort of special relationship that you seem to have with it.
Yeah, it was fun figuring out, okay, what is blue about? It's about this distantness and the sky and flying. And just for me, part of the melancholy pleasure of blue is this dreamy, it really is the color of distance, the color of things that are far away. Mm-hmm. And one of the times I remember feeling it really strongly, I was hiking on the mountain closest to San Francisco, Mount Tamalpais. And from the mountain, San Francisco looked like this beautiful, dreamy blue city. Everything was blue. I really wanted to go to that blue city. Mm. But of course, I just left it. And when I left it, eggs were yellow, wood was brown, grass was green, lipstick was red. And you get lots of emails every day.
And while you're answering them, you think about how nice it would be to go hiking on the beautiful blue mountain in the distance.
Yeah, my life does get really busy. And maybe the state of being busy is feeling like nothing is far away. You're just so busy dog paddling to stay afloat in this moment. You can't really contemplate the horizon.
That's why we need the blue.
It's an invitation. An invitation maybe to be calm, to be contemplative. Maybe it's the color of thought. I think distance has been adult taste in a lot of ways, and that kids are like medieval paintings. It's all about the foreground. They live in the moment and what they can engage with in a really active way. You know, we're the ones who are gazing off in the landscape talking about how beautiful it is. And they're not. And then I think one of the really interesting things about old age and memory loss is that often you lose the most recent memory first, and the distant past might be more real than the immediate past. My mother has Alzheimer's, and she became even more preoccupied with her childhood and her mother and things that had happened 60, 70, 75 years ago. And so the very old often are the opposite of children in that they remember what happened a really long time ago, but they don't remember yesterday or 10 minutes ago.
Yeah.
And so human nature is such that kids are all foreground and no distance, and the old live in that distance. They live in distant memory in the past and not in the here and now so much.
That's interesting.
You know, and they're also... Oh, go ahead.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Something just clicked for me when
That's
you were talking.
That was enough.
it seems like what we're really talking about actually isn't geographic distance, but like time, really, you know, because the blue of distance is some kind of time. It's a temporal distance as well. It's the time from here to there.
In a sense, there's lots of ways in which time and space correlate, but I'm not quite sure, you know, off the top of my head, even on pre-recorded radio, quite how to solve that equation.
Mm-hmm. This is wonderful. Thank you so much for
Absolutely
taking the time.
Great, thank you. And then we fade into the distance.
That was reporter-producer Lynn Levy with Rebecca Solnit. Thanks so much to both of them. Rebecca has many books out there, all of which are so worth a read. Please check them out. And thank you, as always, for listening.